Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today, from Jerusalem, in Jerusalem, your guest and my guest is Vincent Lemire. Vincent Lemire is the director of the Centre de Recherche Française à Jérusalem, or the Centre for French Research in Jerusalem, and is the author of a number of volumes about Jerusalem, which we're going to talk about. Vincent, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, Vincent is a good friend of mine. We've been working together on a number of projects, but that doesn't mean I'm going to change my first question. So, Vincent, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
I'm an historian. So maybe I will tell you a story. I will try to tell you the history of Jerusalem. My first time here was in April 1995. So we were in the middle of the Oslo peace process. There was a lot of hope here. We went for dinner in Ramallah or Jericho. We went everywhere from west to east, and I had many friends here in West and East Jerusalem. I still have, but the situation was way more hopeful. And so this was my Jerusalem during that time. I don't know if it's still the same. And sometimes, somehow, I'm thinking, why I'm still here? I think this is a question for a lot of people here in Jerusalem or around Jerusalem or outside Jerusalem, but somewhere they know that they will come back. It's a strange thing. I spent 5 full years without coming here from 2004 to 2009. It was at the end of my PhD. I thought that it was done with Jerusalem. I thought, really, sincerely, I did work on other topics and so on. And I don't know why in 2009, in this office, believe me or not, and just in this very office where we are sitting now in the CRFG, because I was invited in Birzeit University, for the annual congress of something. And so I organized to just to come to from Paris to Birzeit and back. But the director in that time of CRFG, Sophie Kessler-Lesguich, she passed away a few months after that. She wrote to me and she told me, why just come and have a coffee? And we were seated exactly on that table. And she told me, you haven't finished with Jerusalem. It's not done. And I said, yes, I'm sure. I'm fed up with this city. I don't want to. So she said, why are you in Birzeit today? And I was invited. I have friends there. It's done. And she said, no, it's not done. You have a lot of work to do and you have a responsibility and so on. And it was Sophie Kessler-Lesguich, and she passed away a few months after that. And I'm not saying that Sophie was among many people, like, you know, a sign on the road. And finally, I came back, and even I came back with my family and children from 2012 to 2014, and I launched the Open Jerusalem Project, and now I'm director here. So yes, my Jerusalem is a long story, and it's not always easy, but I'm still here. Yeah,
it's hard to escape Jerusalem. I share the same story. At some point, when I finished my PhD and I worked, in Jerusalem, publish my stuff, and then all of a sudden, I really wanted to work on something different. And yet I'm still here working on Jerusalem, coming to Jerusalem, and it's very hard to escape this yeah, yeah. logic and the chains, this in a sense.
This is the real Jerusalem syndrome, I think.
I think so. I think I would agree with you. More than the syndrome of becoming some sort of prophet is really to get attached to the city and never being able to leave that city. I want to talk to you about your work. Your work is extensive. There's a lot of things to talk about Jerusalem through your work, which is fascinating in many ways. So I remember reading your first work on Jerusalem years ago. And I must say that was very hard, not only because my French was good enough to read academic French, but also because of the topic itself. Your first work was dedicated to the question of water. In French, the book is called La Soif de Jérusalem. And essentially, you really looked into the history of water in Jerusalem, which is something that not many think about it, despite the scarcity of water in the region. But there is an history about water, and there is an history of a relationship between water and Jerusalem. So I was wondering if you can tell us more about this history. You know, what's the relationship between water and Jerusalem in the city?
Yeah, it was indeed. It was my PhD work. I spent something 7 years on this work, from 1999 to 2006, precisely June 2006, and the book was published in French in 2010, and it was never translated because, as you said, it's too big. It's way too big. It's not only too big, but way too big. But sometimes there is people here who tell me, I read the people who are visiting Jerusalem, the tourists, and so on and so. But yeah, it's a very scientific work. And the story is that one. I come here from Cairo. I was living in Cairo, learning Arabic, and in that time it was very easy to travel from Cairo to Jerusalem, even by bus. I remember through Gaza, and I had the project to work not on Jerusalem but on Jaffa, and municipal history of Jaffa, and I spent 6 months working on Jaffa, looking for the municipal archives, and I didn't find it. If someone had some information, it could be very interesting, but it's a big, big issue. Where are the municipal archives of Jaffa? I don't believe the story that it's destroyed, because it's usually the archives are not destroyed. They are somewhere, but this is an issue. And so I was depressed, and my PhD director told me to go to Jerusalem and work on Jerusalem, and I didn't want to. And for 6 months, I resisted. I said, "No, I don't want to come in Jerusalem. It's madness there. It's a battlefield. There's too much people, and it's historians." And he said, "Go there, and try to work quietly, and try to find a way in Jerusalem." And I spent 6 months more. It was a good time. We had time in that time, yes, to search and to look for a PhD topic. And it was Robert Hilbert, my director, and he used to work on Alexandria, municipal history of Alexandria. And he told me, why? Just go to the municipality of Jerusalem and ask them if they have archive. And so I went there in the new building, and I asked them. There was Menachem Levin, who were an excellent director and archivist, and he showed me the municipal archives, and I immediately discovered that the water supply issue was big in the municipal archives. So, and in maybe 10 days, it makes connections, because I read a lot of things about history of Jerusalem and ancient history and medieval history and everything, and the water was everywhere. And why? Because Jerusalem is on the top of the mountain. It's 800 meters above the sea level. And so before the before you have an electric pump, you have to bring water from an upper level than Jerusalem, which is very difficult. So it was an issue from, let's say, first temple period till 1960s. So it was a way to tell a modern history of Jerusalem, 19th and 20th century history of Jerusalem, very concrete, an everyday history of Jerusalem, but with the long term, the long durée history that I wanted to work with, because I'm sure I'm not the only, because we are sure, we know that we cannot tell a short-term history of Jerusalem without looking for the long durée, because the long durée is always getting to the streets and to the everyday life of the people. So the work and so that's why I called it the subtitle is Essai d'Hydrohistoire. It's an essay of hydro history of Jerusalem. So it's not the history of water in Jerusalem, because it's not a technical history. It's an history of Jerusalem through the water supply issue, and it, of course, it brings a lot of issues inside, religious, because the water is religious, administrative, politics, archaeology, and you know, memories, heritage. And so at the end, I spent 7 years on this topic, and some people was thinking that I am a specialist or the specialist of the water history of Jerusalem, but it's not. No, I'm still a specialist of the history of Jerusalem. It was just a way to get in, I think.
And if I may, I mean the chapters you really delved into the question of water as a way to understand the history of Jerusalem, and I was wondering if there's any story that stands out in your work and that you want to talk about, something like connected to a specific well or water source, or how people actually managed water in a city which was, you know, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-linguistic. So how was the water essentially managed between the various communities?
The short story is that one. It's the water supply issue is a place of meeting and of sharing, and when you say water in Jerusalem, everybody think about the geopolitics issues, and the settlers are taking the water to the Palestinian, which is true today and so on, but in a urban context, in the Ottoman context, and even at the beginning of the Mandate context, it was a topic for which people are talking, sharing, and dealing with on pragmatic ways. There is one story maybe to tell among many, but the water of Jerusalem is coming from from the sky, because it's raining a lot in Jerusalem. Everybody who knows the city, it's raining almost the same amount of water in Jerusalem than in London, like something like 500 millimeters a year, or in Paris, or in that kind of or Normandy. But the difference is that in Jerusalem, it's just 5 months, 6 months a year, and it's like 10 episodes, very strong, and you don't have a lot. There's the rock everywhere, and there is the mountain, and so the issue is to get this water inside the city. So that's why we have a lot of system and underground systems and so on. This is the first structural. This was the first structural. A way to get them some water in Jerusalem. But the second one was a big infrastructure in south of Bethlehem, between Bethlehem and Hebron, Al-Khalil, really on the road in the small valley called Artas, where everybody can go now. You take the road 60 and pass Bethlehem on your left, and 5 kilometers after that you turn left, and this is Artas, and there you will discover three huge birket pools, water pools, and the first one is coming from, let's say, before Christ. Before Christ, we know that during Ponce Pilate there was one huge water pool there, and there is an aqueduct from Artas Valley to Jerusalem, and where in Jerusalem? To the subterranean of the Haram al-Sharif. So the connection in even the very place of the water in Jerusalem is very important. And Artas Valley is a place where there is a lot of Palestinian people who are making salads and fruits and so on, even for Jerusalem. And for centuries and centuries, they were complaining about the urban people, the citadins, I don't know how to say it in English, the urban people of Jerusalem are stealing the water of our poor peasant of Artas. And in 1925, there was a crisis, an hydraulic crisis, but among others, and the British decided to take maybe more water than other years, and so the villagers of Artas are complaining like they did for centuries, but they are not writing anymore, urban people of Jerusalem are stealing the water of poor villagers of Artas. They are writing, the Jewish people of Jerusalem are stealing the water of our Arab villagers of Artas. And this is exactly what I wanted to explain. It's not a history of water in Jerusalem, it's a history of Jerusalem and the whole region through the water. You can see, for example, that you have a conflict, a very classical one, between villagers and urban people for the water, which you can have in every places in the world. But at the beginning of the Mandate 1925, there is a rewording of this conflict, and because the big, huge history, geopolitical history, and conflictual history is coming above this, let's say, small water history. So this is just a short example to show that I tried to build some links between this, yes, technical water history of Jerusalem and the big. The big picture, the big history of the Holy City.
Perhaps one day some of the chapters might be translated into English. We can't make this promise, but
this very story is published in the Jerusalem Quarterly years ago in Arabic and in English. If you type something, if you look for Artas, Artas, Lemire, Water, Jerusalem, something, you will, Jerusalem Quarterly, you will find it.
So this is a step forward. Mm-hmm. You mentioned something very important. The question of the water and water supplies as a meeting point. People met at the wells, at the water fountains, regardless of identity, religion, language, because these were meeting points. So this brings me to your next work, which I found fascinating. And I must say that I had the privilege to read it even before it was published. Jerusalem 1900, but I'm more fascinated by the subtitles, The Age of Possibilities. And one of your arguments in the book is that by the beginning of the 20th century, Jerusalem was a city open to possibilities. There was no inevitable conflict, and this is an argument which I think we all can share, regardless of different political views, that there is no such a thing as an inevitable conflict. And you are painting Jerusalem as a city, like many others, where interactions led the future of the people, and there were possibilities, roads that were taken, and of course, roads that were not taken. Can you tell us about this 1900, this beginning of the 20th century?
Yeah, it's very important because before it was a book, it was a lesson that I teach to my students in Marne-la-Vallée, east of Paris. So I don't know if you can imagine, I was trying to explain something about the history of Jerusalem to my student, history student in Marne-la-Vallée, and I tried many ways, the long durée, the short term, summarizing my PhD, but no, someday I had an idea and I said, I will tell them the Jerusalem 1900 history, which is not, of course, it's not exactly the 1900 history. It's, let's say, the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, and we have the Young Turk Revolution. Yeah, it's still, yes, let's say till the Young Turk Revolution, which is, as everybody knows, it's kind of, yes, turning point in the history of the whole region. It was maybe another way, a second way for me to try to add something, because this is the problem, the problem that we all have here, because a lot of thousands of books, thousands of historians and good ones, and in many languages, and so you have to think about how can you add something useful, and how can you work widely and try to understand something. And when I was working on the water supply of Jerusalem, I was very interested by the municipal history of the city. I was interested by this forgotten history, because it was largely forgotten, the history of the municipality of Jerusalem, which is the oldest one in the Ottoman Empire, dated from 1863. Even before Istanbul, you have a municipality in Jerusalem, which is a mixed one. It's not a perfect one, of course, there is a lot of problems there, but it was a place where the people were seated once a week around a table dealing with the urban issues, like garbage, like sanitary conditions, like water supply, like public transport, like public tax, slaughters, everything. And we don't have this institution now in 2021. As you know, we do have a municipality, but around the table, you just have some Israeli people. And East Jerusalem is not anymore in the municipal process. And it's, of course, a big, big issue, maybe the biggest issue. And everybody now is talking about always, yes, important issues, Haram al-Sharif and the holy places and so on. But I always said, yes, do not have a shared municipality there. And without a shared municipality, you cannot progress in any ways, even on the political, these very political and symbolic and sensitive issues. So the municipality of Jerusalem was my main focus on this. And about what you said, yeah, the history of possibilities. I had some critics and I received it as good ones, but some people told me sometimes, yeah, you tried to write a pink history of Jerusalem, like. And I said, no, if you read the book, there is a lot of conflict there, a lot of and riots, but the lines are not the same than today. I'm just saying that. And it was not just Jewish against Palestinians. It was more, way more complex and way more rich. And the conflictualities were, the more you have conflictualities, the more you have solutions. And the problem now is that we have one big conflict above everything, and it's very difficult to deal with. So I just wanted to put some more complexities in this history. And yes, I published it in 2000, 12, I think, yes, 12 in French. I was very happy because after that it was published, translated and published in Arabic in Beirut by Dar al-Farabi, and in Hebrew by Magnus Press University, which is the editor of the Hebrew U, Hebrew University in Jerusalem. So for me, it was a kind of, yes, to have a book on the history of Jerusalem published in Arabic, in Beirut, and in Hebrew in Jerusalem, plus in English in Chicago. It was, I think, yes, I was right. I was not, of course, I was not the first one to tell this history. It's kind of synthesis book, but maybe I found the way to, yes, again, to word something which was on the table of many searchers. And this question of possibilities, maybe it was an answer to my own, to our own sadness and desperation. It's like we can see that the history of Jerusalem is not going in the good way, let's say, put it simply. And just if you are thinking as an historian, knowing that sometimes you have experimentations, historical experimentations, which failed, because it did fail. This the Ottoman municipalities disappeared and exploded in 1934, or during the mandate, you don't have any more a shared municipality, so it failed. But maybe you can find there some ways to get some hope for the future. This is the only pink history that I'm writing. It's maybe for the future.
Yeah, I understand some of the criticism that you have received. Sometimes I remember when I read the book, there was the sense that you were trying to paint things better than they were. But you were right. I mean, there were many conflicts. And the fact there were many conflicts, it meant that they were smaller and more manageable. Sometimes were due to property issues, even family conflicts. And often they were like either intercommunal or intracommunal, but they were managed by community, something that you no longer see nowadays in Jerusalem. Certainly we didn't see since the mandate, where obviously a larger conflict took over all of these micro different issues. And I don't think that's really pink. It's more painting the reality of urban conflicts, as we saw in Jerusalem and in other parts of the world, in many other cities. I just want to bring you to the other big project that you've been working on for a number of years, which is Open Jerusalem. Open Jerusalem is an ERC-funded project. And I don't want to say more than this, because you probably have so many things to say about how this came about, how it developed, and also how it ended. So, Vincent, what is Open Jerusalem? We are going to take a short break. Thank you for listening. And remember to join our Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram account. If you have a story about Jerusalem that you want to share, or someone that you want me to interview, please get in touch. Enjoy the rest of the show.
You know a lot of Open Jerusalem, dear Roberto, because you were part of it. You were one of the, yes, not only the supporters, but you participated in it. This Open Jerusalem project, it was just after Jerusalem 1900, because I applied in 2012, so when Jerusalem 1900 was published. And I was here for 2 years in Jerusalem as a searcher in CRFG. And to tell the truth, I was blocked. I was looking for a new project, because I was here, I was paid for it. how we are and how we have to be. And I had no more ideas, like personal ideas. I was, the water history is done, Jerusalem 1900 is done, and I wanted to make something more huge, but not because more huge and more global, and to understand globally the history of the city. And I had this strategy, water history, okay, Jerusalem just 1900, okay, but what next? And I had the idea that I have to bring more people with me, around me, and I had to bring the big team to work on this history of Jerusalem. And I had the experience that the issue of the archives was a very important one, like everywhere, but more than everywhere. Why? Because archival stuff is, of course, a strategical issue everywhere, but even more here in Jerusalem. And second, because in Jerusalem, you have archives, a lot of archives outside Jerusalem, because even because of geostrategical or geopolitics issues. Some institution here get the ideas, and I think maybe yeah, they're right, that the papers has to be outside Jerusalem. So you have a city, you have a global city with many people there, talking many languages, writing many languages, so producing archives in many languages, in many alphabets. And when you are an historian and you arrive, if you are Greek, you are working on the Greeks just before you know the Greek language. And if you are Armenian, you work on the Armenians because you know the Armenian language, and because maybe yes, you have more access to the archives, and so on and so on. And even in the West Jerusalem, the Sephardim are working on the Sephardim, and the Ashkenazim, and so on. I did the more and more I discovered that there was a lot of histories of Jerusalem, many thousands of histories, and everybody was working on the documents which he has on his table, on his desk, and he and maybe for political reason, but even often for just linguistic reason, he was unable. An historian is unable just to look to the table of his just neighbor because it's written in a different language, and even he don't know what's the topic of this very document. So the idea of the Open Jerusalem project was to bring together a huge team. The world team is something like 60 people, from 60 searchers from around 15 countries, and to deal with this one only issue is the archival issue. And this was the first idea. And the second one was not to focus on the question of digitalization, and to begin with the description of the archives, because we discovered that many projects spent many times and money and energy for digitizing archives without even knowing what there was featuring. And plus, when you are talking about digitalization with a lot of institutions here in Jerusalem, but everywhere, sometimes it could be difficult, because when you digitize some papers, in a way you take it. So the strategy was that, and I think it was the only good idea in this project. It was the good idea in this project. It was to begin with an outside and inside description of the documentation in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, in West Jerusalem, around Jerusalem, and in Russia, and in St. Petersburg, and in Rome, and in Paris, and in London, and in Istanbul, and Amman, and Addis Abeba, and Washington, and it's endless. Of course, so the result is now on the website, www.openjerusalem.org, and here you can find something like 39,000 documents described. And the third idea was, we will describe this document in English, which is a scandal, as an archivistic scandal, because as an archivist you must describe the document in the same language, then the document, and it makes sense, because As soon as you translate it, even the description, even the title, even the you lost some information, and you put some noise in this description. Everybody knows that. But I was thinking that there was the biggest issue, and the biggest issue was the historian of Jerusalem. If he's working on, I don't know, if he's working on water supply, he can type water, and he will have hundreds of documents from dozens of communities. And after that, he has a description, he has a summary of the document, and he can say, oh, but I have a friend who can read some Armenian, or I have another one who knows someone who can read the Gez or the Amharic or someone. We have a network. But the first step is to have the first access to the document. So this was the strategy. It was a crazy project. It was a huge one. 5 years, so from 2014 to 2019. Thanks God, it was before this COVID-19 crisis, because I don't know how many planes I took, and sometimes just for 2 days or 3 days in Ethiopia, and another 2 days in St. Petersburg. It was crazy. We had to go everywhere to work with the insiders. This was another idea. Another idea was not to build the team from below and from the field. And really, we did it, which is we arrived in in Yerevan, for example, or Chelyabinsk in Armenia, and asked, what do you have? And do you have people there who do work or might work? And we can pay for this work, and we can share the results. And so it was a building. It was a trust building process, and a scientific one. And I think we did succeed. The website is working. It is working very well. I know that it's a lot of people are using it. There is much more digitalized archives than we thought at the beginning. Because if you look at the website, 1/3 of the document do have some digitalization version, so it's good, and every month we add some more stuff. For example, in the coming months we will add all the Jordanian Jerusalem municipality archives in the website, which will be a huge step forward, because as you know, Roberto, of course, the history of the Jordanian East Jerusalem is a dark period. It's not a dark period, as it's a gray period. We don't know almost anything about that. And so we did describe all the municipal archives, which are here in the Israeli municipality, and we will put it on the website. And we do hope that some more historians, master, PhD, everything, seniors, will work on this Jordanian history of Jerusalem, for example.
I have a question about the material. Working on archives, it means you're working on paper. And for many people out there, archives are just these buildings where there's a lot of paper. What people may not understand is that actually those papers are about real life, are about people. So I was wondering, in your experience, how do we translate that paper into the life of people? Because sometimes it seems there's a disconnect, but as we see now with the current situation in Jerusalem, particularly in Sheikh Jarrah, actually documents are relevant to people in real life.
Yeah, you ask an excellent and big question and challenge, because when you are dealing with archives, as you said, yes, you are dealing with papers, but more than that, you are dealing with institutions. Those institutions are producing archives. Private people are not. Or yes, academics sometimes, but yes, first of all, the institutions are producing archives. So when you are focusing on archives, of course, you are focusing on institutional history. And it could be, yes, it could be a problem. And we have to find ways, as you said, to build some links between this institutional history and archive. We have to assume it and everyday life history and the people. As you said, Cheikh Jarrah, for example, if you type Cheikh Jarrah on the Open Jerusalem website, you will find some document and you will find something to think about the current situation. So, but still, you're absolutely right. We ended the Open Jerusalem project in 2019 because it was the end of the funding, and we knew that we had done the first step, and still we made a lot of effort to make it like a public what we call public history, but still there is a lot of work to do, and there is a lot of work to do. Maybe one way could be to work on 3D reconstruction of the Jerusalem of that time and to put some archives on it and ask people to put some personal family history on it and so on. This is a kind of thing that we are thinking about. There is a lot of project around this challenge. For example, I know that you received Marie-Velma O'Neill weeks ago, and she's working on the Mogabe neighborhood around this kind of strategy. How to build some links between the big institutional history and the everyday history. And it's a very important issue in Jerusalem. It's very risky. Right. It's very risky because as soon as you ask people to take part in the process, yes, you will have a lot of noise, you will have a lot of conflict, you will have a lot of misunderstanding, and you will have a lot of everything. But now, because the Open Jerusalem project is, yes, it is stable, it's done, we have it. We are thinking, this is a scoop that I tend to the to your podcast, dear Roberto. We are thinking about a second step, and maybe it will be a huge one. Maybe it will be a huge one. When I say huge one, I'm thinking about European funding. I'm thinking about, because it's not just let's put these results on a more friendly website. It's not this kind of issue. We are talking about how to involve people, how to build an excellent app that you can add on your iPhone or your cell phone and in the street, and how you can get the information, how you put the archives as you put links between the archives and the place where you are working in the old city and so on. So it's a huge issue, and we are dealing with it. We do have partners, but of course there is a lot of political issues in this idea. But we are thinking about it, and you're perfectly right. This is the second step that we do have to move on. Yeah.
I have a couple of more questions before the end of this interview. You just talked about Open Jerusalem opening the archives, and that made me think that for some people, opening the archives is to find that kind of history that you don't want to hear about. Archives may be a fearful place, a place where you find something that tells you something different from what you learned in school, from what your family told you, from what you your friends and neighbors told you about, where you live. So I was wondering, Open Jerusalem is such a powerful project and idea. What were the challenges? How people reacted to your idea of opening?
To be honest, we didn't get a lot of public reactions. I don't know if it's good news or bad news, really. I don't know. It's both, I think. It's good news because, Open Jerusalem is a safe zone, it's a safe place. It's an academic work, and so I'm not attacked by any side. The bad news is we need to take this risk. We need to make the people of Jerusalem, the peoples of Jerusalem, east, west, and not only east, west, but everywhere, in every kind of people and in every communities, looking inside the documents. And as you said, sometimes you find what you want to find, and sometimes you find another thing. And it's not so, we are historians, so we know how to deal with this kind of surprises. This is how, this is an ethical, yes, it is our ethical engagement. But when you're just a citizen, you go to the archives to find, for example, to find your rights. And if you don't find it, and if you find rights for other people or other neighbors, it could be difficult for you. So, but we did try to, for example, we published with two colleagues a short book about the Ethiopian community in Jerusalem, which is not so well known. Everybody come on the rooftop of the Holy Sepulchre, but you have two or three pictures. Oh, wow, it's strange. They're on the rooftop and they go back downstairs and back to the Holy Sepulchre. But the history of the Ethiopian community in Jerusalem is crazy, and it's linked with so many big histories in Jerusalem. And so we published this book just to try to have a qualitative approach on one single community. Again, it's an academic work, and I'm not sure that, but it will be published, now it's published in French, and it translated in English, and it will be published by Brill in English next year in the Open Jerusalem Theory. But yes, we do try to, for example, you ask for about the reactions, and it's exactly that challenge. We go to the Ethiopian monks and ask them, do you want to be on the picture or not? It's a provocative question, but it is. And there is an only way to be on the picture is to show us the archives. And some of these archives will be good for you, and some of these archives will be not so good. But this is the game. And we convinced them, and we have to be on the picture. And of course, the Ethiopian especially, because their position is not so sure. They are on the rooftop. There is a Coptic there, the Armenian there, the Greek everywhere. And for the Ethiopian, it was not so easy. So they decided to work with us, and they are very happy to. Because they discovered that the work is honest, it's just serious, it's just scientifically robust, and so they can bring something, and they can take the book and read it, and even take what is useful for them. It's in this book, but in every books that we wrote, Roberto. Everybody can open it and use the sentences which are useful for their fight, and it's okay. We don't have to complain about it.
I must say that part of the Open Jerusalem project is this idea of not making claims, which I really appreciated. That instead of writing history with the purpose of making one claim, Open Jerusalem produced works that are, published with the purpose to talk about issues and to show the material in the archives. I have one last question, and it's connected to your work, but also to your personal life. Now, Open Jerusalem deals with a question of citadinité, a very difficult word to translate into English, which is the idea of belonging to an urban environment. So I was wondering, do you belong to Jerusalem? And when you go around Jerusalem, what are your favorite spots?
Again, I will try to be as honest as possible. Because I'm French, because I'm European, so I have some privilege as a French, as a European here. I can travel everywhere. Comparing, for example, with the East Jerusalem population, of course, I cannot say that I am a Jerusalemite as them. This is the very first answer, and it's very important. And even more than that, I'm working as director of CRFG. I have a diplomatic protection. So the first answer is no. And in this no, there is an ethical, engagement, which is, I don't want to think that I am, I am mixed and I'm living with the population of Jerusalem, because I'm not. I'm just looking to the history of Jerusalem from the outside. And sometimes when you look from the outside, you see some things that you just cannot see from the inside. And in Paris, I don't see anything. I can understand some things, but I'm not seeing it. And sometimes when I'm here in Jerusalem for too long times, I'm not seeing as well as before. This is a very, very touchy issue, but the outsider and insider and in every topic. And but in France, if we didn't had Robert Paxton for re-explaining us the period of the Second World War, we were still in the same weird debates. So the first answer is no. I'm looking at the history of Jerusalem from the east, from the outside. And the second is yes, because I'm here. I'm here for more than 20 years, because I'm always coming back here. And if you are asking the place, there is a lot of there's a lot of place that I like, and it's outside places. It's places when I look to Jerusalem from the outside. One is far away. It's Nabi Samuel mountain, as you know, it's high, much, much higher than Jerusalem. It's the Mont Gaudi, Mont Joie mount, and you have a church, and you have a synagogue, and you have a mosque, and it's a very, very inspiring place. So I like to bring my friends there to look at Jerusalem from far away. And in Jerusalem, I can just say that there is a place that I don't like, and I think maybe a lot of people don't like this place. A place where I am uncomfortable, and I know a lot of, for example, Jewish people and even observant Jewish people are not comfortable with, which is the Wailing Wall, Plaza, because it's mixed of a lot of things, and because I did work for several years now on the Mogabi neighborhood, which was just on the Wailing Wall Plaza till the Six-Day War. And when I'm in this place, I remember that I think every historian of Jerusalem has to remember every day, every hour, this city described as an eternal city where heritage is everywhere, blah, 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 is a city where everything is transforming every decades, every centuries, it's not an eternal city. It's a very, very historical city, and we have to deal with it. And even the more difficult part of this history, and of course the history of the Mogabi neighborhood and the Wailing Wall Plaza is a part of it. this will be my next step, and more difficult and more touchy than the steps before. But yes, we have to move forward. We have to grow up. So
this was Vincent Lemire, currently the director of the Centre de Recherche Française à Jérusalem, author of a number of publications and the upcoming work on the Maghrebi Quarter, which will probably be the subject of another full interview, but just dedicated to it. Vincent, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Roberto.
Thank you for listening to Jerusalem Unplugged. This podcast is currently commercial free. There are no ads. The only possibility to stay this way is for you to please let your friends, your family, and others who may be interested in listening to Jerusalem Unplugged know about this podcast. Let's increase the audience and let's keep the podcast commercial free. Thank you for listening. Until the next one.